This talk is from the 3rd Annual Illinois Catholic Prayer Breakfast, held April 30th, 2010 in Chicago. For more information, go to www.illinoiscatholicprayerbreakfast.com. For more talks by excellent Catholic speakers, go to greatcatholichomilies.com. This talk is part one of the talk by Bishop Salvatore Cordiglione, the Bishop of the Diocese of Oakland, California.
Good morning. Thank you very much. Thank you for your warm welcome and the beautiful California weather. I enjoy being in Chicago. I'm still trying to understand this Cubs-White Sox rivalry because in the Bay Area we have two Major League Baseball teams and two professional football teams, and everyone cheers for both teams. We all just kind of get along because it's California. I'm honored to be here with you, and I'm grateful and honored by your invitation, and I'm happy that my schedule is able to work out that I could be here and share some thoughts with you and reflections. I would like to begin my remarks by the first part of the talk reflecting on the Pope's latest encyclical, the one on Catholic social teaching, Caritas in Veritate, and how this encyclical weaves together different principles of Catholic social teaching and connecting all aspects of life, what we could call a human ecology, a term that the encyclical actually uses. Fundamental to all of that is the question of marriage, so I would like to then go into some reflections on the campaign to save the definition of marriage in the law in California, share, as time will allow, my experience of working on that, not just because for some it would be an interesting story to hear, but in order to set up my conclusions, and that is the lessons that I've learned from that campaign and lessons we can keep in mind for going forward. Pope Benedict's recent encyclical, though, is dedicated to developing Catholic social teaching in the light of the current economic crisis, and so it does weave all those principles of Catholic social teaching throughout the encyclical. But before referencing any particular one, it is necessary to bear in mind the very premise of the encyclical, already clear at the outset from its title. Charity must be connected with truth, and that truth has to do with the correct understanding of the human person. The starting point, of course, is the very beginning, God's creation of the human person. The foundational passage in sacred scripture is Genesis 1:26, which tells us that God created the man and the woman in his image and likeness. God, moreover, created them in order to share in his nature, and so the vocation of every human being is that of divine beatitude. The pastoral constitution on the church in the modern world of the Second Vatican Council, Gaudium et Spes, reminds us that the human person is the only creature on earth that God has willed for its own sake, and that human persons can fully discover their true self only in giving of themselves. This being created in the image of God gives the human person an inherent dignity. Because of the origin and destiny of human beings, which is already written in the human heart and made evident in Scripture, Catholic thought sees the human person as primarily a spiritual being, that is, one who is much more than merely the sum total of bodily functions and psychological and emotional needs, but rather one who is oriented toward a transcendent end, which is nothing less than God himself. This means, then, that all human life is sacred and worthy of respect in every stage and in every condition. And this is why the Church does not shy away from her duty to defend and speak out on behalf of human life and dignity, wherever they may be in a position of vulnerability. Of all of the fundamental principles of Catholic social teaching, this necessarily is the first, because all others flow from it, the inherent dignity of the human person, along with its corollary principles of the spiritual transcendent nature of the human person and the sanctity of human life. Note, this dignity is inherent. It is based on being created in God's image. It is not a dignity granted by the state or decided by the high and the mighty for the weak and the vulnerable. Whenever a society veers off in the direction of social injustice, it is inevitably because of a basic misunderstanding in this area. We can, for example, think of what the world was like at the dawn of Catholic social teaching. When Pope Leo XIII issued the first of these social encyclicals, Rerum Novarum, in 1891, the Industrial Revolution was in full swing. The plight of workers had become critical. the demand of their labor had become urgent, but protections were not yet in place to safeguard their rights. Remember also that at this time, the political philosophies of Marxism and socialism were very much on the rise as a response to this situation by promising a society of justice and equality. The problem with these philosophies, though, is that they base everything on the material. Their concept of the human person is devoid of any sense of the spiritual or transcendent. Instead, social justice is brought about by conflict, the warfare of the classes, which results in revolution, leading to a classless society. The 20th century, which we have just left, tragically witnessed the horrendous consequences of these systems. With extraordinary foresight, Pope Leo XIII gave a Christian response to these circumstances of his time. Yes, his encyclical's central theme was the just ordering of society, but according to criteria that correspond fully to the nature of the human person. He therefore listed the errors that gave rise to social ills and excluded socialism as a remedy. The truth of the human person, then, exists in objective reality, what nature is like. It is not left up to each individual to decide for himself or herself as if I have my truth and you have your truth. Reason helps us to discern and recognize the truth, which then must be received by an act of the will. Truth is to be received. It is a gift. Benedict says that charity rooted in objective truth is a grace. He says, charity is love received and given. Therefore, as he says, without truth, charity degenerates into sentimentality. It is ultimately dehumanizing. The powerful give, not because the need of the giver to give exceeds the need of the receiver to receive. That is because, again, Gaudium et Spes, human persons can fully discover their true self only in giving of themselves. But instead, for some ulterior end, whether it be simply to assuage a troubled conscience, or worst of all, to keep the weak dependent on the powerful, who can thereby rest secure in their position of power. This then defeats authentic development, which can only come about when such initiatives respect the truth about the human person. As the Pope says, the risk for our time is that the de facto interdependence of people and nations is not matched by ethical interaction of consciences and minds that would give rise to truly human development. Only in charity, illumined by the light of reason and faith, is it possible to pursue development goals that possess a more humane and humanizing value. Ultimately, truth and love are a person, Jesus Christ, by whom and for whom everything was created. The two then cannot be separated, but rather form a dynamic unity. This means that our integral development as human persons, individually and as a community, decisively becomes real as we lovingly seek the truth and allow it to form us and to shape and motivate our action in the world in accord with the demands of love. Integral human development, the Pope tells us, then requires the difficult task of subordinating the material and technical to the spiritual and moral, and not allowing financial mechanisms free rein outside the civic and political aspects of society. In other words, we must respect this hierarchy of values if we wish to order our society correctly and thereby attain authentic development and enduring justice. We must likewise respect the principle according to which everything is interrelated, something we can readily understand at the level of the physical environment. Air and water do not know political boundaries. A polluted river in one country will be polluted in its neighboring country. Bad air quality in one city will affect the communities surrounding it, especially when they are downwind from their big neighbor. I come from San Diego. I grew up in the city nestled between Los Angeles and Mexico, so these are realities that I have experienced firsthand. These are also realities about which we are all committed to improving. The church certainly is no exception, but the Christian perspective does so in a way that places the primacy on the spiritual. Cognizant of the truth that our natural and physical environment is God's creation and expression of his love for us, and is his gift to us as our home in which we seek our salvation, the church exhorts us to be good and respectful stewards of the environment. Indeed, the church proposes that there is a covenant between us and our physical world. We all understand the urgent need to care for the natural environment and the complexities that this involves because of everything in the environment being interconnected. This, though, is a basic operating principle in all of creation, and so it applies in all the other areas of life as well. We certainly understand its application to the economy, and if there ever could have been any doubt, the current global economic crisis has done away with that. It applies at the level of physical health, in which the various systems of the body are interconnected. It also applies, therefore, on the spiritual and moral levels. Moreover, all of these different levels are among themselves interconnected, with each affecting all the others. To put it another way, I can cite your spiritual director, my classmate and dear friend and accomplished artist, Father Thomas Loya, who taught me that the mark of a great artist is consistency of design. God is the creator of the universe, the divine artist and all-perfect one, so we can expect that there will be a consistency to his design of the universe and of our human nature. This, then, is why the Church calls our attention to the relationship between the moral order and the physical order. Just as we must be concerned for the ecology of our physical environment, so must we also be concerned with human ecology, our own proper moral order. In Caritas in Veritate, Benedict picks up this theme and emphasizes the intimate and unbreakable relationship between the proper moral outlook of society and its ability to respect nature. He says, "In order to protect nature, it is not enough to intervene with economic incentives or deterrents. Not even an apposite education is sufficient. These are important steps, but the decisive issue is the overall moral tenor of society. If there is a lack of respect for the right to life and to a natural death, if human conception, gestation, and birth are made artificial, if human embryos are sacrificed to research, the conscience of society ends up losing the concept of human ecology, and along with it, that of environmental ecology. It is contradictory to insist that future generations respect the natural environment when our educational systems and laws do not help them to respect themselves. The book of nature is one and indivisible. It takes in not only the environment, but also life, sexuality, marriage, the family, social relations. In a word, integral human development." Let's go back to the beginning. The creation account in Genesis says, "God created man in his image. In the divine image he created him. Male and female he created them." Man here is obviously meant in its inclusive sense, humanity as a corporate whole. Humanity can only exist as male and female. Hence it is the masculinity and femininity of the human race that reflects the image of God, a trinity of persons in perfect unity. Moreover, God has established a human institution by which he could model for us his inner life of unity. That institution is marriage, in which a husband and wife fully and unreservedly give themselves to each other. Benedict puts it this way at number 34 in Caritas in Veritate. "Just as the sacramental love of spouses unites them spiritually in one flesh and makes out of the two a real and relational unity, so in an analogous way, truth unites spirits and causes them to think in unison, attracting them as unity to itself." Sacramental love of spouses. Remember, a sacrament uses a physical reality to connect us with spiritual, transcendent truth. In marriage, a man and woman are physically joined in a one-flesh union, while each retains their own identity. The mystical meaning of marriage underlying its physical reality connects us with and helps us understand the mystery of the Trinity. This is why marriage is the iconic human relationship for unity and diversity. The man and woman are and remain diverse, but united by their mutual complementarity. Accordingly, the first structure of human ecology is the family founded on marriage. It is the environment created by the spouse's mutual gift of self that children can be born and develop their potentialities, become aware of their dignity, and prepare to face their unique and individual destiny. That's from Pope John Paul II's Centesimus Annus. The family founded on marriage, then, is the first vital cell of society. In light of all this, while to the ill-informed it would seem a complete non sequitur, I'm sure they're left scratching their head, to the well-informed Catholic, It comes as no surprise that early on in this encyclical addressing the current global economic crisis, Pope Benedict references Pope Paul VI's encyclical Humanae Vitae on the transmission of human life and responsible parenthood, and Pope John Paul II's Evangelium Vitae on the sanctity of human life as foundational for the entire discussion. We see people not as an asset or a liability, depending on their condition, but as a gift, a resource, indeed the greatest resource, regardless of their condition, an intrinsic good. Sex and marriage are indeed foundational to everything, because people come about through the sexual union of man and woman. Pope Benedict cites Evangelium Vitae at this point when he says, "The Church forcefully maintains this link between life ethics and social ethics, fully aware that a society lacks solid foundations when, on the one hand, it asserts values such as the dignity of the person, justice, and peace, but then, on the other hand, radically acts to the contrary by allowing or tolerating a variety of ways in which human life is devalued and violated, especially where it is weak or marginalized." Pope even uses the phrase openness to life, so pivotal in Humanae Vitae's discussion of the responsible transmission of human life in marriage, in reference to authentic economic and social development. He says, "Morally responsible openness to life represents a rich social and economic resource. Populous nations have been able to emerge from poverty thanks not least to the size of their population and the talents of their people. On the other hand, formerly prosperous nations are presently passing through a phase of uncertainty, and in some cases decline, precisely because of their falling birth rates. This has become a crucial problem for highly affluent societies." We know our concerns about the demographic demise in developed nations. He concludes here, "In view of this, states are called to enact policies promoting the centrality and the integrity of the family founded on marriage between a man and a woman, the primary vital cell of society, and to assume responsibility for its economic and fiscal needs while respecting its essentially relational character." Think about it. The family is the primary cell of society, and if that cell is infected, then all of society will be infected. And we can go further. Marriage is the primary cell of the family. If, therefore, the marriage is infected, namely, disordered by notions contrary to the truth of the human person and the purposes of marriage as established by the Creator in the order of nature, then so will the family, and consequently all of society. As the first vital cell of society, the family founded on marriage is the basis of social justice and education. This is why I became actively involved in the effort to defend marriage, including and especially its definition in the law. You all know that I was an active promoter of Proposition 8 from very early on in the process. I suppose that has something to do with why I'm here today. I never thought that anyone, let alone I, would achieve something of a celebrity status simply for speaking in public about the importance of understanding marriage as the union of a man and a woman. I never could have conceived that that would have ever happened. But as we saw in the video, we're at a crucial point in our history. I knew it was controversial, and I knew it would probably lead some people to stereotyping me politically. But I also understood how foundational marriage is to everything. I also understood the consequences of losing this definition of marriage in the law. And I think we're all aware of the losses of religious liberties and rights of conscience when this type of legislation becomes more and more placed in the law. So I did not let controversy or the risk of being stereotyped slow me down. So I suppose just about everyone knows that about me by now. What people don't know about me is that I was part of, when I was in San Diego, part of an interfaith coalition that met with the district attorney there to urge her to place a moratorium on the use of the death penalty. People also don't know that I was part of a year-long ecumenical discussion group of pastors which reflected theologically on local issues, and living in a border city, most of our discussion centered on the plight and rights of immigrants. Most, and perhaps all of those pastors, opposed me on the Prop 8 issue, and some even actively so. Yet, even after the election, we respected each other. Again, there is a hierarchy of values, and we cannot treat all of these issues in the same way. Some have to do with grave intrinsic moral evils. Others have to do more with the question of where is the higher moral ground, or what is the most humane public policy that best corresponds to these principles. But when you take them all together, we Catholics do not fit perfectly into any convenient political pigeonhole. This is what it means to be simply Catholic. Seeing the world not through a political lens, but through the lens of the correct understanding of the human person. That has to be played out in politics as well as other areas of life, but that has to be the lens that we look through. And that is why I believe that we, from our Catholic perspective, have a unique and very necessary, indeed, vital in the literal sense, contribution to make to our national life at this particular moment in history. We know well that there are some people, many people, especially people in positions of influence, who see things from a purely political perspective, and so would be perplexed by our Catholic perspective. They would, for example, see irreconcilable differences between those who, say, defend the sanctity of life and traditional marriage and those who promote care for the environment and economic justice. Again, we recognize a hierarchy of values, but we understand how all of these issues are interconnected and all are necessary for a moral society, for a healthy society. Now, one does not need to be Catholic to understand this. But our Catholic tradition does make it a lot easier, and we have to help the people of our nation get there. And that includes many of our own people. Many of our own people don't understand this.
This talk was from the 3rd Annual Illinois Catholic Prayer Breakfast. For more information, go to www.illinoiscatholicprayerbreakfast.com. For more talks by excellent Catholic speakers, go to GreatCatholicHomilies.com.